Court is now ready for argument in the last case of the day, United States against Ambrose. Mr. LaFuma.
May it please the Court. Good morning. My name is Frank LaFuma, and I have the distinct privilege of representing John Ambrose before this honorable court. One of the issues before the court is whether Ambrose was in custody on September 6, 2006. And in this court's de novo review of that issue, the standard is whether Ambrose was deprived of freedom of action in any significant way.
You know, you argue that he didn't feel he was free to leave the interview with Grant and Fitzgerald. But how do you reconcile that with Mr. Ambrose's own inquiry that as to whether the interview would be concluded in time for him to make it to his scheduled parent-teacher conference at 6 p.m. that night? I mean, someone who thinks he's been arrested is not thinking about whether he's going to get out in time to make a parent-teacher conference. He's thinking that, you know, he's going somewhere else that night. And, I mean, doesn't that alone indicate that he did not believe that he was not under arrest?
Judge, that's a very, very, very good question. It's a probing question. It's an important fact. But it has to be considered in context with the other facts. It's 5 hours later, Your Honor, 5 hours after he's initially confronted by Fitzgerald and Grant. And on top of that, Judge, if you're looking at that fact alone, you're neglecting to look at a series of other facts.
I'm not looking at that fact alone. During the interviews, he's able to meet privately with the people that he requested to see, including a member of his family. And to have one of those people with him when continuing the interview with the agents, that's highly unusual. I've really not seen that. Aren't those factors also indicative of a person who is not in custody, but, you know, who's free to leave if he so desires?
I respectfully say no, Your Honor. And let me go back real quickly to the first question you had. The agents did not allow him to leave when he asked if he would be able to leave and meet his wife to go to the parent-teacher conference. In fact, they told him, we will let you call.
That's not the point. The point is that he asked the question, not what the agents tell him, but that he, of his own free volition, felt that he could ask that particular question. It's not a question that a person who believes himself to be arrested would normally ask. You know, look at the time. Am I going to, you know, get out by 6?
But, Judge, this is also after there's been several hours of interrogation, first with Fitzgerald and Grant, then with McNamara and Stamat. It's only after that is concluded that he asks a silly question, perhaps, like that. But the fact is the agents didn't let...
It may be a silly question, but it's a question indicative of his of where his mind is.
But they were also, Your Honor, probing him about cooperating and wearing a wire against this guy, Guidi. So the circumstances of that conversation were never totally fleshed out because, I respectfully submit, by the time we got there, it had already been clearly determined that he was in custody based on the innumerable other facts. And in the question the court posed, the second one about having Mr. Hansen present, who is his uncle, he was not allowed to make that phone call to Hansen. The agent made the call to Hansen and had him brought over to help him in his decision at that point whether to cooperate against this guy, Guidi.
What difference would it make who made the phone call? The phone call was made, you know, court security officer Hansen is there. What difference would it make who made the phone call?
I think that it's not just Hansen, Your Honor. It's also Marshall Widdup, who John Watt was concerned about his job, and he wanted to talk principally with
now,
the marshal.
Now, another issue. If you think you're under arrest, is the first thing that you're worrying about, you know, will I keep my job? You're worrying about, will I, you know, survive this? Will I go to jail? Will I be indicted? Will I
Judge, this is after they've already presented him with an affidavit with his name on it. It's 30-some pages long, listing a series of crimes, and that affidavit is dated September 6, 2006. The duty magistrate for that day is on there, and Fitzgerald basically said this is an affidavit that's ready to go to court. So that had already been presented to Ambrose before he started asking about his job. The accusations, the confrontation, the videotape was played, the transcript was presented, and the affidavit was presented, and Ambrose is reading through the affidavit before he says, now how does this affect my job?
That's all in what I'm thinking of as stage one of his discussions with Patrick Fitzgerald and Mr. Grant. And then there's a break with this washroom incident that you talk about, and then stage two is further conversations with the two of them.
Correct, Judge. It is. There is further conversation, and that's when Mr. Hansen is present.
Right. And so what I'm trying to figure out is how you integrate these three various stages with your argument under Missouri against Siebert, because it's not until the third stage with the agents that he receives his Miranda warnings.
Correct, Your Honor. That's true. And that's why it was planned in advance that way, and that's why Marcus Funk's email from earlier that week lays out the entire, you know, two-stage interrogation technique where they were deliberately thwarting Miranda's or Ambrose's Miranda rights. I mean, it's crystal clear. They have a series of bullet points in that email, and it says have written Miranda waiver handy after Pat Fitzgerald questions Ambrose or gives him his spiel, and then it craft that pitch, he tells the agents as well, so that we get false exculpatories if he lies. Now, one of the principal things that I think Judge Grady relied on, and this court perhaps is considering as well, is the government raised in the court below and raises here that they were concerned about Ambrose's well-being and his potential for suicide, which was nil, of course.
But I am less worried about that, since I don't think this is a subjective test. I think it's an objective test. But underneath that objective test, there are findings of fact. And the district court, it looks to me, finds pretty clearly that it was Mr. Ambrose's choice to stay and talk, that he thought, for rational or other reasons, what it doesn't matter, that he thought he would be better off if he continued to talk with these people. So if that's the case, then how does that coincide with the finding of coercion?
Well, Judge, I respectfully submit that that's an erroneous finding of fact by Judge Grady. Judge Grady relied on the key fact, as he put it, that Pat Fitzgerald told Ambrose he was not under arrest. Now, I know we're stuck with that, but nobody else heard that except Grant, who also said he said it, so let's avoid that controversy. Let's say that was said. This court recently, United States versus Slate, said when it's clear to a suspect that he is in custody, you don't have to ask, am I free to leave?
Well, that's just one fact. I mean, you would agree it's a factor. I mean, other factors could overwhelm it, but it's a factor, isn't it?
It is a factor that can be considered, but Judge Grady said that was his key factor, Your Honor. And additionally, in Slate, you know, a similar argument was made. The government had probable cause in both cases, both here and in Slate.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Judge.
We're dealing with a very intelligent individual who is a law enforcement professional.
And had a Miranda card in his pocket, surely.
And has been around for a long, long time. And if he thought he was under arrest, surely he would have said, you know, quit it. Guys, I need a lawyer. I want a lawyer.
Judge, you might be giving John too much credit in how intelligent he is. He did have experience for sure,
well,
but
he certainly got into the United States Marshals Service, and the United States Marshals Service is made up of many of the most intelligent human beings I personally have ever known.
I agree, Judge, and may I suggest this as well, though. He's brought into a room with two very intelligent people who have tag-teamed, as they put it, to really shock and surprise him, get his attention, and put pressure on him. This is Pat Fitzgerald we're talking about. Any agent from this district who would be brought into a room to be questioned by the highest-ranking FBI agent, as well as Pat Fitzgerald, would feel fear. And I don't think the first thing on his mind was leaving. It was especially when they sat him down and said, here is the evidence against you. Look at this. Read this. And then they started asking him questions. So the standard also, Judge, is the standard of a reasonable person. This isn't the voluntariness issue we're looking at right now, which I think you would consider his background. But what would an average person in Ambrose's shoes feel at that point in time?
So before you run out of time, I wonder if you could just say a word about the hearsay point that you've raised. Because one of the things that you have talked about is the Marcello tapes and how they link up the leak to Mr. Ambrose directly. But I thought that there was some other evidence also in the record indicating that he was the kid or that his father was one of the Marquette Ten. Only this one tape?
Well, Judge, I believe that. I'm not recalling anything else, but I believe that was the one tape, and that's where the government said the kid is Ambrose. Guidi is John Ambrose's father's old partner. Durango is mentioned. The Marquette Ten case is mentioned. No, there's nothing else that's there other than Ambrose's statements to Fitzgerald and Grant and McNamara's statement.
But wouldn't it be harmless given Ambrose's own admission that he provided information that, you know, that was confidential?
Judge, this is where there's a breakdown in this entire case. The government submitted and Judge Grady accepted that there could only be one source. And our view was there was more than one source. And Ambrose was negligent and said something stupid, but he did not give away the entire farm to this guy, Guidi.
Yeah, well, giving away 1% of that farm.
And that's probably what the jury found, Judge.
Is very problematic.
But please remember, the Marcellos never mentioned the WITSEC program, witness security, the safe site, the U.S. Marshal Service, but they did mention FBI agent Wax. They did mention a USA named Collins repeatedly, and the term, Judge Wood, kid, was also used with the kid with the Collins guy. And that certainly wasn't Ambrose, because Ambrose was questioned about his relationship with Collins and Notre Dame, and there was no such relationship. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Ms. MacArthur.
May it please the Court, my name is Diane MacArthur and I represent the United States.
Why did a group of agents have to shadow him even when he went to the restroom if he wasn't in custody? Is there any evidence in the record that the FBI work on that particular floor is of such a confidential nature that any visitor to the floor would have to be accompanied by an agent at all times, let alone four?
Your Honor, there was one reason certainly that the agents accompanied him, which is to say that Mr. Ambrose was in a law enforcement building with confidential information as well as guns available. But, Judge, there was also a very significant concern that day.
But doesn't that mean he was in custody, basically, unless you're saying that the record showed that all people on that floor were accompanied into the restroom and somebody would hover in front of the stall?
It does not show that he was in custody. There is a policy.
Well, what about the other question? Is that the practice on that floor, that if I were to visit it and go to the restroom, somebody would be standing outside to make sure that I didn't peek in a file drawer?
Yes, actually it is, Your Honor. It is a protected building. Guests are escorted. Not FBI personnel are required.
Into the restroom.
Into the restroom.
You are escorted to the restroom. In this particular case, there was also...
But here they had someone standing right outside the stall.
There is a dispute as to the proximity of the person, Judge, but the reason...
Was the person within the restroom?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, then does it matter how far from the stall he was?
It does if...
How big is this restroom?
It's large. But, Judge, the important point here is that there was a significant concern about Mr. Ambrose committing suicide or acting out in some way. He had received...
But the district judge doesn't find that as a fact. I mean, I know you all said that. He denies it entirely, and you put a kind of a strange interpretation on his "don't worry, I won't do anything stupid" remark, when, in fact, the stupid thing would be to try to slip out of the room and go away, which takes us right back to the custody point.
The district court did acknowledge that he thought that the protective detail for the washroom was overblown. But the important point there is timing. Mr. Ambrose had made statements before he even saw any agents associated with the conference room. That was the first phase that Your Honor referred to.
But I'm not sure he says that. I think he was well aware, certainly as an experienced member of the Marshal Service was well aware that that even the conference room was tightly guarded. That's what he says.
Your Honor, in his affidavit, he said that he saw agents when the door opened for the water or washroom break. There's no reference to agents being in his mind before he entered the room, the conference room, for the first phase of the Fitzgerald Brand meeting. And significantly, Judge, after that washroom incident, Mr. Ambrose met with the three people of his choice, had separate 10-minute private meetings with each of them, and at the end of those three sessions, one of those people, Mr. Shank, came out and said that Mr. Ambrose wished to meet more with Mr. Fitzgerald and Mr. Grant.
Right, but I'm not sure that that tells me too much about custody, because it seems to me I can think of years worth of drug cases that I've seen at this court where somebody who is a member of the drug conspiracy is taken into custody by the agents. That person chooses to have, you know, conversations for some period of time, tries to figure out whether some form of cooperation will yield more lenient treatment. So I'm not sure that your notion that he wanted to keep talking tells us whether he was actually in custody or not. I think it's maybe drawing a conclusion that's not warranted.
Judge, then it's important to look at Mr. Ambrose's own words and his own conduct when he did return to that room. Significantly, as Your Honors pointed out, there was the question by Mr. Ambrose in the third phase, the agent meeting, later that afternoon, where he said, "Will I make this parent-teacher conference on time? If I'm late, my wife is going to kill me." Significant statements on his part to show that he never thought that he was under arrest.
Well, but there's another way of reading those statements. The government criticizes him for not saying, "Am I in custody?" or "Am I under arrest?" But actually, that's a way of saying exactly that. Will I make the parent-teacher conference? Because that could have elicited, "Of course not, you're going off to the Kane County Jail tonight." And so I'm not sure you can have it both ways.
Well, Judge, Mr. Ambrose also said during, I believe, either the first or second phase with Fitzgerald and Grant, he acknowledged, Mr. Ambrose himself acknowledged in his testimony, that Mr. Fitzgerald told him he was facing possible charges. And from that statement, too, it's clear that in Mr. Ambrose's mind, he had not yet been charged. It's also significant.
It's not clear. I mean, it's maybe a way you could look at it.
Judge, this is a person, a law enforcement person, a reasonable person in Mr. Ambrose's position, who was told by the U.S. attorney and the head of the Chicago FBI that he was not under arrest. That means something. That means that each of the top heads of this organization is telling him he's not under arrest.
Not yet, but he has also in front of him the draft complaint with this day's date on it and with the correct magistrate judge's name. So I think there's a yet in that statement.
That, though, combined with a statement, "You are not under arrest," means from the top people involved to a person like him with his training, his supervisory experience, that he's not under arrest.
So are you equating arrest with custody? Because there's a difference, actually, between the two. You could be in custody and not yet be under arrest.
That's true, Judge. The district court did not make that distinction.
I'm making it, and you are assuming that just because he's told he was not under arrest, he automatically wasn't in custody, and I don't think that's necessarily a correct statement of the law.
Judge, there were none of the hallmark measures of custody apparent in this case. There were no handcuffs. He was meeting in an FBI's head's conference room.
In a highly secure, as you've emphasized.
With 11 agents surrounding him.
And with all of his personal items having been left at the gate.
Okay. It was a public space in the sense of it was the head's conference room area. It was not an interrogation room.
But this you said just now that it was so secure and confidential that even I would be escorted to the restroom in this area.
That's correct.
This is not really too public.
But on the other hand, Mr. Ambrose is a law enforcement person, and he knows about security in buildings and the need to have escorts when you're not in a regular building. In terms of his personal property, I know he says that his car keys were taken from him, but that isn't supported by the transcript sites in the record. His car keys were taken because he had to go through a magnetometer. Mr. Prout's testimony showed that what was kept was the BlackBerry and the weapon that each of them carried into the building. Even Mr. Fitzgerald told Mr. Ambrose that Mr. Fitzgerald's cell phone was taken as a part of the security process.
Can we talk about the Marcello conversation? Because you argued that the recording of the Marcello conversation was relevant to explain why the FBI was led to investigate him. But doesn't that, I mean, that same evidence that would, you know, cause the FBI to suspect him also lead a jury to suspect Mr. Ambrose of the crime? In other words, what I'm trying to get at is how can that be separated as a practical matter from using it for the truth of the matter?
The jury did hear that, Judge. There were limiting instructions given to the jury before they heard the tape for the first time.
Yeah, well, you know, the district court tried to correct its mistake and remove the most troubling portion from the jury's consideration, but isn't the bigger problem here that the jury had heard that same portion of the recording because it was repeated in the government's opening and again repeated in Marcello's testimony at trial, given, you know, that it was essentially a statement by the recipients of the leak as to who gave them the information? Is there any way that can be harmless?
Yes, Judge, and here's why. First, the jury did hear it twice. But in this particular case, the defense theory...
The jury heard it
three times,
right.
Actually. Yeah.
They heard the tape twice, and you're correct.
But they heard Mr.
But
Funk.
They heard, you know, the... three times. That's one more than two?
That's correct. I apologize. But here's why it ultimately is harmless error in this case. The defense theory in this case was that Mr. Ambrose spoke with Mr. Guidi, that he shot his mouth off, that he effed up, that he made certain statements about a protected witness.
And interestingly, the jury believes only these very narrow statements, you know, that he... you know, that he spoke about Mr. Calabresi, but the jury rejects almost all of the arguments that you made.
This is how I see the jury's verdict, Your Honor, and that is the jury rejected, in effect, the detail contained in the tapes, which is why it shows that the back and forth, the in and out nature of the Marquette 10 clip had no ultimate effect on the jury.
How do we know? I mean, we don't know. We don't know how much effect anything ever has on a jury. Can you point specifically to what admissions by Mr. Ambrose, related directly to the offenses of conviction so as to make any evidentiary errors harmless? That would be...
Here's the step-by-step, Judge. The September 11th statements that Mr. Ambrose made are untouched by whatever you decide concerning the suppression hearing. September 11th...
So it's your view that this is a strict liability crime, I take it, that as soon as somebody has uttered a statement to... and it's overheard by another person who shouldn't have heard it, that liability is established...
There is an intent element, Judge, but yes, essentially that's it.
So you think it's so if somebody were chatting on their cell phone and didn't realize that another person was nearby, you'd still have the violation. So there's no amount of inadvertence in your view.
I'm hesitating only with the intent element, Judge. The information
was a critical part of Mr. Ambrose's defense.
Correct.
That's how he explained the quotes that you referred to a minute ago.
But the requirement is not, as he phrased it, criminal intent. You can still have the intent to release the information, which he clearly did here.
But the only information you released, according to the jury, was that he worked on and was assigned to the witness's WITSET security detail and that the witness was brought to Chicago.
That's correct.
That's it.
And that's why the...
And that his fingerprints are on the files.
Exactly. And that's why the admissions...
But there was a legitimate reason for the fingerprints to be in the files, conceivably.
The point there, Judge, is that his fingerprints were on what we call the big file and not on the briefing materials themselves, which he would have gotten as a part of the normal course.
So normally a United States Marshal would not be privy to the big file?
He may have been privy to it, Judge, but he wasn't specifically given it as a part of the briefing materials. He made two statements on September 11th.
What's your evidence that there was something wrong with his having access to this file?
None, Judge. He was entitled to have access to the file in the
safe. So the fingerprints don't mean anything.
They do mean something, Judge, in that it appears that he took an affirmative step to reach out and look at the big file itself beyond the briefing materials.
Whose else fingerprints were on it?
There were, I believe, other people associated with the safe site crew that was in there that night. Mr. Ambrose made two statements on September 11th and compared those two with what the jury ultimately found. September 11th, with his attorney present, he said, as to the first detail, I ran into Guidi and told him I babysat a no-see guy. He essentially says the same thing, repeats the same thing as to what he told Guidi after the second detail, with the addition of the information about traveling to Sox Park. You look then at the jury's findings, and this is how you know that this is harmless error. The jury's findings were that he worked on and was assigned to the witnesses' WITSEC security details, and that the second piece was that the witness was brought to Chicago as a part of the WITSEC program. Those two findings by the jury are consistent and completely parallel with the statements that Mr. Ambrose admitted in his lawyer's presence on September 11th and that his lawyer told the jury in opening and closing statement as the given in the case, the common ground.
Before you run out of time, I wanted to just float one issue I have with the sentence. The district court judge has a theory about why Mr. Guidi might have wanted information from Mr. Ambrose to look, you know, important, et cetera. But his explanation is devoid of any motivation that Mr. Ambrose might have had to do all of these things. And yet, using the authority that he had under Watts, he essentially sentences Mr. Ambrose on the basis of every last thing that you charged, not just on the basis of the things that the jury found. And so I'm having trouble figuring out what, since it clearly wasn't money, you know, what Mr. Ambrose's motive could possibly have been.
Well, it was his putative father.
The judge never says that. I mean, if that had been the district court judge's finding, then, you know, okay. And how did Mr. Ambrose wind up with a prison cell that overlooked where his father died?
That's very troubling to me, too, Ms. McCarthy. Very troubling.
The information about that is limited and is confined to the record concerning the back and forth when it was raised by Mr. LaPuma. And it was simply that the Bureau of Prisons informed us that they had made a decision based on their consideration.
How many federal prisons are there in this country? How many, Ms. McCarthy?
I know, Judge. I wish the decision...
No, but how many?
Multiple. In multiple states, Judge. I wish the decision were different.
You think there are 100?
At least.
I think that maybe 200? At least. How does this fellow get to that particular prison?
I don't know, Judge. I don't know if it
has... It's really inexcusable. I mean, the government isn't supposed to torture people.
I feel what you feel. If I may respond, Judge, to the point you raised concerning the judge's concern about motive. The judge first noted that in earlier conversations, Mr. Ambrose had provided a reason as to why he leaked the information, that being wanting to curry favor with the mob in order to ultimately catch Mr. Lombardo should he become a fugitive. The judge noted that that reason was apparently withdrawn. It was no longer pursued. The district court then provided what the district court, based on his understanding of the record, was as the motivation, because of the nature of the relationship with the father.
He doesn't really spell that out too much, but, I mean, we can sit around and speculate, I suppose. But that's...
And, Judge, that finding was limited to the nature and circumstances of the offense. When it came to actually structuring the length of the sentence, it appears the district court judge focused much more on the need for deterrence and to promote respect for the law. Those were his reasons.
Right.
Difficulty in detecting the offense.
Yeah. Right.
If Your Honors have no further questions, I'll sit down. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. MacArthur. Anything further, Mr. LaPuma?
Ms. MacArthur indicates that Judge Wood, or perhaps any federal judge, would be escorted in the 10th floor of the FBI's high secure building. Well, I certainly doubt it would be five agents would be surrounding the person, the judge or whoever, to that restroom, and then strategically, as they put it, place themselves within the restroom, with Agent Jurek specifically stating he stood right outside the stall where Ambrose relieved himself. And even if that was going to happen, it's very doubtful that a federal judge would be sitting in a conference room in the FBI building alone and then stand up and stretch her legs and an FBI agent come in and command and demand that judge sit down and remain seated. And when the person says, I'm just stretching my legs, that the agent would advance toward the person and repeat the command and point to the chair. So custody, I think, is pretty well established here. I think the judge used the wrong law. With respect to the Marcello tapes, Your Honor, the government emphasized the truth of the matter asserted of that particular tape. in its opening through the examination of its first agent, Michael Maseth, who was the case agent, word by word, his own interpretation of what those words meant and what the Marquette 10 case meant, and he even threw in that the Marquette 10 case was a case where Ambrose's father and several other police officers protected drug dealers for money. So it went well beyond the restrictions Judge Grady initially placed on the case. And then Marcello got up there and talked about, well, this is what I heard and this is what this means. And only then did Judge Grady recognize, I made a mistake and the jury should ignore this. But there were other tapes, Your Honors, that were admitted as well that should not have been played because they also were used for the truth of the matter asserted.
And you moved for a new trial at the end of the trial? I'm trying to remember the sequence.
We moved for a new, yes, we filed a written motion for, well, at the end of the government's case, of course, we did, and at the end of the case, and then in our written pleadings as well, Your Honor, yes. Okay. With respect to the big file that Ms. MacArthur discussed, our reply brief discusses Inspector One's testimony, and he talks about the fact that that was an imperfect file. He did not know whether he pulled out the original documents early on or later. I would encourage you to please look at the reply brief to show that there is no indication that Ambrose did not have proper and professional access to that file, and that could be the reason for his fingerprints on the file. Inspector One's testimony settled that score right off the bat. There is no other admissions by Mr. Ambrose on September 11th when I went with him several days later. In fact, it was a very short meeting. His position about things that he purportedly said several days earlier had changed. And I can tell you this, at no point did he ever tell the government in any of the sessions that he told Guidi, that he admit to Guidi, that it was Nick Calabrese, never mentioned, that it was a protected witness, never mentioned. All it was that I guarded some big OC guy. That's the extent of it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.